This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
To see why Americans defy federal law to free the radio airwaves, on the ways to the rise of big media, the growth of citizen media to encounter it, and witness their showdown over the truth during the 1999 World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle. See the battle to free the airwaves live and find out the real price of freedom. This event is being co-sponsored by KPFT 90.1 FM Radio for Peace. That's Wednesday, February 25th, 7 p.m. at Rice Cinema, located at Rice University, entrance number 8.
KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on this evening's program, you know what they used to say in the old Western movies? There's a new sheriff in town. we've got a new sheriff, and we'll be talking with him. And then, of course, we also have News Wrap from This Way Out and the other features from This Way Out. And we also have Eric Rowland of Legacy, and we'll find out what Legacy is all about. And the Bayou City Boys Club, that kind of emerged from, well, it's written here as humble beginnings, but you know how that goes. 1993. And so they're going to be here to talk about Jungle Lust, which comes up, you know, it used to be called something else, and we can't say what that is. And so that comes up every year around Easter or so, and it's a good fundraising effort. And also this evening, the Northwoods Unitarian Universalist Church, that's up on the north side, folks, that's up on the north side of Houston, are going to publicize a GLBT event that they want to keep on the down low. So we're going to talk about something that they're trying to keep secret. Okay, makes sense to me. So all that and more this evening on Queer Voices.
Hi, this is Jennifer Renee, and Jack's here in the office, and we have our special guest tonight. Yes, the new sheriff in town, Adrian Garcia, the newly sworn in, what, you've been about a month now?
Over a month.
Over a month. That's terrific. And our new sheriff, and tell us, I know that you've been very, very busy, because you're awfully hard to catch anywhere. definitely a moving target.
Oh, yes. I mean, look, I got 1,700 square miles to cover, and I got to stay moving. But it's
not everybody knows it's the third largest county in the country.
It is.
And what is the rank of the sheriff's department?
It is the third largest county in America. It is the third largest by manpower sheriff's department in the country. However, we are the second largest county jail in the country.
Second largest. And, you know, our population is about evenly divided between the cities and in the counties. So you have just about, as far as the county areas, you're covering about as many citizens outside of the cities, aren't you?
Very close to that. And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is that as part of the, you know, the responsibility that I have as sheriff, it is to provide police resources in the unincorporated areas of the county. The unincorporated area of Harris County qualifies as the seventh largest city in America.
Did not know that.
Yep.
That's something that all of us should know, that,
yep,
that it's a monumental job. Well, how are you doing it? What is your manpower in relation to that?
Well, you know, I think when you talk to any law enforcement executive, you'll always hear we could always use more people. But the reality is that right now I am down approximately 200 positions. And so I want to take this opportunity that if there's anybody that's interested in a career service, I would encourage you to apply to the Harris County Sheriff's Office. I've got positions in both the classified area of the department, as well as I am actively hiring detention officers. I need detention officers. So we have opportunity for both. And so I would encourage people who would be interested in a career service to please visit the Harris County Sheriff's Office and apply with us. But I am down. I do have vacancies. And but when you look at the national average of police officers to 1,000 residents, the national average is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.8 officers per 1,000 residents. The Harris County Sheriff's Office currently has about 0.9 officers to 1,000 residents. So we are way off the national average mark. Now, the sheriff's departments across the country tend to have a 1.4 ratio that they go by. So and even in that regard, I'm down people for handling calls.
What sort of recruiting efforts are y'all trying now? I mean, well, this may be early on in your deal, but I can imagine that you're already wanting to recruit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I made the commitment that when I took office that I would be the chief recruiter of the department. I mean, because if the boss isn't saying, I want you to come work for me, then I don't see how a deputy could do a better job than me. And so I am doing the basic grassroots aspect of recruiting. Every speaking opportunity that I have, I'm talking about the department. I'm talking about, you know, there's a lot of things that we need to improve in the department, but there are a lot of things that are still good. And in this economy, we've got a paycheck ready to give somebody who's, you know, ready to earn it. But by the same token, the vision of what we have in store for the department going into the future is a vision that I believe that people will want to be a part of. We want to be the lead law enforcement agency in Harris County. We want to be the lead law enforcement agency in the region, in the Harris County, the Harris-Galveston County region. And we have lots of plans in store for the department. We want to really establish ourselves as a sheriff's department that knows what to do with regards to homeland security priorities. We want to be a sheriff's department that has a model detention center for the people that are in our custody, and that we're providing the right care for them. And but by the same token, making sure that we are keeping the most violent, most dangerous people in custody while we look for alternative ways to deal with those that are lower risk offenders.
Any special projects that you're working on that you can talk to us about?
Yeah, I mean, right now there's a lot of discussion about what to do with individuals that are what you would call low-risk offenders, and maybe first-time offenders, or people that are that have been arrested for personal amounts of controlled substances, or people who have, you know, got arrested for something, but who have jobs, who have a family, who have a, you know, a place where, you know, we can find them. And so there's a lot of discussion occurring in that regard. And you know, principally speaking, as a sheriff, I'm the recipient of those individuals that traverse through the jurisdictions of the district attorney and the criminal court judges. And so, but by the same token, I'm a stakeholder, I'm a partner with the criminal judges and with our district attorney. And so there's a lot of good discussion going on between the DA and our criminal court judges, our county judge. And so I'm looking to be a part of the solution and work alongside people so that we can find creative things to do. So some of the things that we've been doing is essentially creating that dialogue. We've got challenges with our mentally ill population. We've got challenges with folks that are being identified as HIV positive for the first time in our custody. So there's a lot of issues that we're working on. We're trying to create effective discharge planning processes for individuals in our custody so that we can make sure to get them from our county jail to community clinics and things of that nature. So those are some of the things that I'm doing involving the detention center. But on other aspects, we're looking to bring a greater presence of patrol deputies out in the community. I think when you have a presence, you have the greatest opportunity to prevent crime. We're also working to really engineer something new as it relates to Homeland Security. One of my appointments that I'm very proud of is a former FBI agent. Someone I felt I needed someone that could communicate At the federal level, mm-hmm. and someone that could bring the communication to the local level, have instant credibility with our law enforcement agencies, our federal agencies rather, and then work to create a real approach to Homeland Security from the local level. Mm-hmm. And so when we get through with our Homeland Security Bureau, it's going to be something that the rest of the country, I believe, will pay attention to because of the way a local law enforcement agency has done it.
There's always a lot of criticism that the local law enforcement agencies should be dealing with immigration policies. How do you answer that?
Well, you know, and I tend to agree that we shouldn't be out there asking our deputies to try to determine who out in the community is a legal citizen or not. You know, first and foremost, we need to make sure that citizens feel comfortable enough to call us when they have concerns or when they are aware of things that are occurring. And we don't need to hurt that line of communication by having people wonder, well, I'm going to call them because I want to report a crime, but are they going to spend more time wondering who I am and where I'm from than the crime I'm reporting? And so I have stayed very steadfast on the position that I will not have my deputies asking for immigration status in the community. Now, once you get arrested for whatever it may be, there are things that I think that are well within the rules of engagement, if you will, that once you come into my custody, we will screen you to see if you have an active federal warrant by ICE. And then let ICE make its determination of what needs to be done.
So basically, it's try to stay clean.
Yeah.
Don't do anything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are very, very challenging times for all of us. But if there are concerns about your immigration status, I would wholeheartedly encourage you try to get those issues resolved as quickly as possible, because once you come into contact with the criminal justice system and you have an immigration a question about your immigration status, it gets ugly real fast.
It sure does. Going back to recruitment and all, and of course our audience reaches a lot of people, but mainly in the GLBT community. What do you say to the GLBT people out there, the gays and lesbians, bisexual, transgender, is there a welcoming environment? We understand there wasn't necessarily one under the old regime.
Yeah, well,
I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that.
I am looking for people who are interested in protecting the citizens of Harris County. I'm looking for people who want a career in service, who have a good personal history, who have led a good life, obeyed the rules, and believe that they can be a service to the citizens of Harris County. That's who I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So if there are folks out there that are interested, I'm anxious to interview you and see if we have a position available for you.
Good. Now, you took over this office after a lot of controversy in the previous leader. Were there things that you found that even beyond what you expected?
No comment. No, listen.
Let us in a little secret. That's just you,
the three of us, right? Right. Well, listen, first of all, unfortunately, I did not get to participate in a type of transition process that I would like to have participated in. All that aside, I've been spending a great deal of time scrubbing the budget down. I'm currently in one budget that I inherited, and we are going into the 09 budget, which I did not have a whole lot of opportunity early on to be involved in. And so we have been spending a great deal of time tweaking the proposed budget, making sure that we have resources that we need to move this organization forward. So we're finding different issues involved with that. And so we're working with all of our county leaders, our county judge, our county commissioners, the Office of Budget Management and Budget.
Is there a good working relationship?
I feel that there is. I am going to do my part to make sure that we have a good relationship. Where it goes from there, I can't speak to it, but I think that principally, with my initial visits with various officials, including the district attorney, I really feel good about our county leadership at this particular time. Mm-hmm. People are interested in the right things for the right reasons, and we're looking to deal with the challenges that we have heard through this last political process, and focus on those things that matter the most to people. And public safety is obviously one of those things that's at the forefront of everybody's mind. And so I'm looking to put the past in the past as quickly as possible so that we can look forward.
We're speaking to Adrian Garcia, who is the new sheriff of Harris County, and he's here talking to us about many of the issues that have come up as he's recently taken over in early January.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was especially interested in when we're talking about enforcing the laws out in the county and all, how many new officers do you have in the budget now? You were talking about the budget. Is the county forthcoming, or the current budget forthcoming to so you can hire new people, or is it just you just don't have enough applicants?
Well, it's actually there are approximately 200 vacancies that I have in the current budget. So I didn't ask for more bodies because I didn't feel I could ask for more if I got vacancies.
Right.
So part of my effort right now is to revamp our recruiting and hiring process to make sure in our training process to make sure that the people that we are, well, first of all, that we are promoting to the community that we're there and or we exist and that we're hiring, actively hiring. And then secondly, making sure that we're sending qualified, competent applicants to the academy,
mm-hmm.
And then working to make sure that we are effectively training them and encouraging them, really strengthening them to be able to graduate through the process. One of the concerns when you talk about what I found is that we have somewhere near a 30 to, you know, maybe in some cases 40% drop-off from of cadets that start the academy to those who graduate. That is unconscionable. I mean, on average, academies have somewhere about a 10 to 15% drop off. We're somewhere in 30 or 40%, and so I have been visiting with my commanders and my majors over the academy, trying to understand this and making sure that we are communicating that. If HR is doing their job and they're sending us qualified, competent applicants, then the academy needs to do its job by making sure that they're training people well. And if we are getting the right quality of candidate, we should be getting a good graduation rate. And then we should be able to get boots on the ground as quickly as possible. So, so there are vacancies that I have. My effort is to fill those vacancies as quickly as possible, demonstrate to our county leadership that we can recruit, we can hire, we can retain, and then start to grow the organization from there.
Yeah. What about the crime lab there at the county?
Yeah, the crime lab is principally run by the medical examiner's office.
Okay.
And I do have a firearms lab. But that's also housed within the medical examiner's office, and so it's a little bit more removed from my operation mm-hmm. than it is in the Houston Police Department. In the Houston Police Department, the crime lab is internal to the department, and here it is. It's a bit of a combination, but principally the medical examiner tends to be serve the purpose of the crime lab.
Do they have everything they need?
No. Actually, they're getting ready to hire. I mean, not hire, but they're getting ready to build a new facility because they've grown so much.
Mm.
I had a chance to visit it a couple of weeks ago, and there's some really fascinating stuff. They got robotics. They're doing tremendous amounts of analysis in various regards. They have a doctor of anthropology that I'm looking to visit to see how we can work together as it relates to our in-custody deaths. So there's a variety of capacity over at the medical examiner's office, and it looks like they've got good leadership there and that they're doing some really exciting things. And so I'm anxious to, again, be a good partner to serve the citizens of this community.
What about the cooperation with other law enforcement offices within the county?
You know, I've heard different things when I came into the office about the degree of cooperation or collaboration, if you will, that existed or didn't exist. All I have worked to do is I've encouraged my majors to reach out to everybody. We've been working to reach out to our constables. I have already had several visits with Houston Police Chief Harold Hurt. I've already had several visits with many of our federal agency partners, several with the FBI, ICE, and DEA, and others, working to make sure that we are saying we're here, we're open for business, we want to enhance whatever mm-hmm. relationships we've had and grow them. But, you know, it's also, you know, some of the things that I want to do as an agency is to make sure that whatever resources we have, whatever information we have, whatever intelligence, whatever technology we may have, that we need to share it. Because Harris County also has 33 cities, most of which have their own police departments, but obviously they're at much smaller budget levels. And so I want to make sure that we are supporting our partners in Harris County. And so I'm hearing really positive feedback from folks who are saying, we've never been reached out before like this by the sheriff's office, and it's a good thing. And we're, you know, I think that's the only way you make good things happen is by making sure you're working alongside.
Can they communicate with each other?
Technology-wise, you know, the county radio system is pretty advanced in contrast to that of the Houston Police Department system. I was fortunate to be part of a long effort to upgrade the HPD's radio system. Once HPD fully implements what they have agreed to purchase, the county will be whole. The region will be whole because HPD will now be at a much different radio platform in terms of communication. And I think that once HPD gets there, most of the region will be on a very, very much stronger level where we can communicate with many more people than we can right now.
One of the questions that maybe a concern, but just a question, the projections are that this county in the next 20 years will double in population. Most of that population increase will be outside of the city, in the county, your area, the mm-hmm. unincorporated areas.
Mm-hmm.
How daunting do you see that? And do you think that the county plans are up to that potential?
Man, you have wiretapped my office, Jennifer, because it would be daunting if we're not talking about it today.
That's why I was asking the question.
Yeah. But one of the things that I've done is I have appointed a major to be over strategic planning, research and development, because we do not have, I believe, a comprehensive enough strategic plan for the Harris County Sheriff's Department. Mm-hmm. And so in some of the things that you just touched on, I spoke to him earlier today and said, look, we need to, as a sheriff's department, be talking about what are we going to do with the growth of the population that's going to be coming to our region. Mm-hmm. What kind of resources is this going to require us to have? What new diversity to our community will this bring? What will that mean to the training that we will need to have?
And the different types of populations that are moving into the county.
Yes, exactly. And so, we need to start talking about it now. And in fact, I've brought in two tremendous business minds to help us in the development of the strategic plan. Mm. Because, I think you can run the sheriff's department like a business. But more importantly, we should at minimum be thinking like a business as it relates to making sure that our resources are planning with, or are growing rather, with the trends that are occurring in front mm-hmm. of us, and that we're planning for that, and that we're looking for ways to get there along with the trends rather than playing catch up all the time.
Now, several years ago, there was, or not that long ago, actually, the bond issue for a new jail, mm-hmm. and it failed
mm-hmm.
For a number of reasons, none of which we won't discuss. How do you see that as playing into that future strategic planning?
Well, it's going to play into it very significantly, you know, or not, in the sense that right now, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of discussion going on between the district attorney and the criminal court judges about sentencing, about pretrial, about personal recognizance bonds. And if all those things play out, we might be able to prolong the need for the construction of a brand new jail.
Mm. Okay.
But if the rate of growth catches up, if the rate of growth catches up before these policies have an opportunity to realize themselves, then we'll probably still need to make the argument for the construction of a new jail. It's just, you know, regretful, a matter of statistics, that as the population grows, regretfully, some of the crime trends tend to grow with that, with those increases. But my hope is that the policies that are being discussed with by the district attorney and the criminal court judges will have a positive effect to our jail population conditions. And if it does, then we can push out the need for spending money on a new jail a little bit further out. You know, if we can make those policies occur sooner rather than later, it'll be a good day, because there's one study right now that I'm reading, reading it for the second time, that is indicating that my jail will be exceeding capacity by nearly 3,000 by May of this year.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. So, you know,
something's got to be done.
Something's got to be done. And so hopefully this discussion on policies will get up and going, and we'll start to see some positive trends as it relates to the population.
Now, going back again to the strategic plan, again, you're talking about even with this, if we're doubling our population, even if the percentage of those that do get incarcerated is small, you just don't have enough beds.
That's right. That's right. And so, and then, you know, you got to remember that we got to figure something out very, very quickly, because a significant number of the population that I have are mentally ill. They're homeless. They're not the violent people that we tend to think that should occupy, you know, county jail space. So we have some real challenges in front of us on how we deal with some of our most vulnerable community members, and how that relates to our jail capacity and things of that nature. I would much rather find better ways to deal with the mentally ill and the homeless than let me have all the jail bed space for, you know, bad people, criminals, violent people, gang members. I'd rather have that jail space for them and not folks that have organic conditions or you know, victims of certain circumstances.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to cover? I want to make sure that we get everything.
Well, let me speak to the vision of the department real quickly. I mentioned earlier that you know, how I want to be the leading agency for Harris County. I want to make sure that I communicate to folks why this is important, and why the aspect of making sure that we're sharing information, that we're talking to people, that we're being good partners with other law enforcement agencies. It is because when you think of Harris County, this is not the same as thinking about, you know, some other county in America, but rather Harris County is critical geography. We have in Harris County you know, output of nearly one third of the national economy by virtue of our port, by virtue of our petrochemical industries, by virtue of NASA, our financial institutions, our transportation systems. One third of the national economy flows through Houston, Harris County. And as a result, that creates tremendous opportunity, but it also creates a tremendous risk assessment for our community. And that's why the Homeland Security Bureau is such a priority for me, because we have all of the risk factors for why a community could be a target of a domestic or international terroristic attack. And so I do spend some sleepless nights thinking about what can we be doing more to protect our community. And so this is why I make such a big deal about putting a tremendous amount of focus on homeland security priorities, is because we need to make sure that Harris County is able to thwart possible attacks, that we are diligent and we are aware of what's occurring in our community. And so I look to sit alongside the table with our other law enforcement leadership to make sure that we are communicating with each other on a daily basis.
Thank you very much. Our guest has been the new sheriff here in Harris County, Adrian Garcia. You're welcome. I hope you'll come back and join us again.
And if you'd like some more information on how to contact the sheriff's office, you can go to our website, queervoices.org, and there's a link to it. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Thank you.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 14th, 2009. It's not all that often that an LGBT rights group sues its country's president. But Moscow Pride filed suit this week against Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in the European Court of Human Rights for failing to mediate its long-running rights dispute with Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov. The activists appealed to a Russian court last year, asking Medvedev to intervene in the continuing refusal of Mayor Lushkov to grant permits for peaceful LGBT pride demonstrations. Russian law requires the president to reply to appeals within a 30-day period. A Moscow court ruled in July, however, that Medvedev is immune from prosecution. This week's complaint against Medvedev was the seventh rights-related filing in the Eurocourt by Moscow Pride. The sixth, submitted earlier this month, specifically addressed the ban of a demonstration on May 17, 2008, the International Day Against Homophobia, during which protesters planned to demand that Mayor Lushkov be prosecuted for systematically and unlawfully blocking all LGBT Pride events. Moscow Pride says the city's various bans violate provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights, guaranteeing freedom of assembly and protections from discrimination. The group is seeking 100,000 euros in damages. Lushkov has called Pride events satanic and said that the bans prevent gay propaganda from contributing to the spread of HIV and AIDS. Cases before the European Court of Human Rights generally proceed rather slowly. It could be more than a year before any of the lawsuits is heard.
A survey released by Ireland's health ministry has found that almost one-fifth of LGBT people have tried to kill themselves because of abuse and isolation related to their sexual identity. 80% of respondents reported homophobic verbal abuse, 58% said they'd been bullied in school, 40% reported threats of physical violence, and 25% said they'd been beaten up for being gay. The study was done by University College Dublin's School of Education and Trinity College's Children's Research Center.
Britain's PinkNews.com reported this week that an Iranian lesbian has been granted refugee status after a three-year battle with the UK's asylum system. Now 42-year-old Pega Emambagsh escaped from Iran after her partner was arrested, tortured, and subsequently sentenced to death by stoning. Her father was also arrested, interrogated, and tortured for information on her whereabouts. She repeatedly said that her sexual orientation and her past life in Iran would have led to her execution if she were forced to return home. According to the British LGBT rights group Outrage, the Islamic Republic of Iran is qualitatively more homophobic than almost any other state on earth.
A gay male couple who also escaped from Iran in 2005 to avoid arrest and possible execution has won asylum in Canada. 32-year-old Ali and 25-year-old Mohammed arrived in Toronto this week. Their surnames were withheld to protect family members still in Iran. According to a report in the Toronto Sun, the couple originally fled to India, where they sought help from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to relocate in Canada. Arsham Parsi of Iranian Queer Railroad told the newspaper that the commission made an urgent and high priority plea at the Canadian Embassy in New Delhi for their resettlement. Iranian Queer Railroad, modeled after the underground railroad that helped slaves from the U.S. South escape to the North in the mid-19th century, said it's helped more than 60 LGBT Iranian refugees resettle in more welcoming locales. It took Ali and Mohammed 3 years to get here, Parsi said. Canada is a gay-friendly country, and they will be successful here.
The Uniting American Families Act was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives this week by New York Democrat Gerald Nadler. It would allow gays and lesbians in relationships with foreign partners to sponsor them for residency in the country. Current immigration law only allows heterosexual sponsorship. Nadler has been fighting for the legislation for the past 8 years. In 2009, he said, "We should be ready as a society to acknowledge that stable American families come in all varieties." The measure, formerly called the Permanent Partners Immigration Act, had 118 co-sponsors in the House last year. Nadler said he's confident of increasing that number in the new Congress. The Senate version, with an initial 10 co-sponsors, is spearheaded by Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy. But he said that immigration reform in general, a political hot potato during the last years of the George W. Bush presidency, suggests an uphill fight for any immigration-related measure. Rachel Tiven of the group Immigration Equality told a media teleconference this week that the estimated 36,000 binational lesbi-gay couples living in the U.S. under current law force the foreign partner to jump through hoops to get a limited series of temporary visas or to live in the country illegally, ever fearful of deportation. Many couples who want to stay together eventually have to leave the U.S. altogether. At least 16 countries currently allow residents to sponsor their same-gender partners for legal immigration, including Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Iceland, Israel, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, South Africa, Sweden, and the United Kingdom.
Same-gender couples are observing the annual Freedom to Marry Week across the U.S. in a variety of ways. Many showed up at county clerk offices this week to request marriage licenses they knew would be denied. In New York City, activists wore signs that said, "Just not married." Banners held by couples outside the Marriage Bureau in downtown Las Vegas read, "Don't hate my love." Couples also sought licenses in Orlando, Florida, San Diego and Fresno, California, Austin, Texas, and Omaha, Nebraska. Rejected couples in Richmond and Charlottesville mocked their state's marketing slogan, "Virginia is for lovers."
Several couples were also turned away from marriage license bureaus in Salt Lake City, Utah. One couple said they didn't feel like they were walking out of the clerk's office empty-handed. They're planning a commitment ceremony in California this April, and as one of them said, "Whether the state shows up or not is up to them. But our family, our friends, and God will be there." And a sign outside the Allentown, Pennsylvania City Hall, where a few couples tried to get licenses, read, "Can we vote on your marriage now?"
Several same-gender couples who got hitched in San Francisco in 2004, when Mayor Gavin Newsom authorized marriage licenses for them, celebrated the event's fifth anniversary with a ceremony in the City Hall Rotunda as part of Freedom to Marry Week. While the state Supreme Court invalidated those marriages, many of those couples wed again during the 5 months last year after the same court made them legal. The voter approved Proposition 8, which revoked the Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling, is being challenged as unconstitutional in that court, as are the validity of some 18,000 same-gender marriages legally conducted from mid-June until that November 4th vote. Dozens of people in Beverly Hills attended a ceremony on the steps of the courthouse to celebrate the renewal of wedding vows by Robin Tyler and Diane Olson, the first same-gender couple in Southern California to legally marry, and in that same place last June. "It's not about marriage," Tyler said. "Now it's about the Constitution."
Dozens of equality activists gathered outside the Maine House and Senate to distribute Valentine's Day cards urging support for a recently introduced bill to legalize same-gender marriage in that state. Hundreds rallied in the Minnesota state capital of St. Paul and in the Rhode Island capital of Providence to support marriage equality bills progressing through their respective legislatures.
Meanwhile, Hawaii's House of Representatives voted 33-17 this week for a civil unions bill that would grant same-gender couples almost all the rights of marriage but the name. The legislation now goes to the state Senate Judiciary Committee, where the vote is reportedly split among six senators, with one undecided. A tie vote would kill the measure for the year.
And finally, Pride was celebrated recently under the summertime sun in two Southern Hemisphere locales. In the Australian state of Victoria, Police Chief Christine Nixon joined about 4,000 participants along St. Kilda's Fitzroy Street in the city's 14th annual Pride Parade. She drew considerable criticism when she first joined the annual march in 2002, but her continued support for LGBT people probably made her the most popular participant this year. She was led by Victoria Police's bagpipe band, with a contingent of about 30 uniformed officers behind her. About 100 groups and other state officials also marched in the parade. And New Zealand Prime Minister John Key danced with drag queens during Auckland's 10th annual Big Gay Out this week, an event originally designed to provide a safe space for LGBT people and to promote AIDS awareness. The Prime Minister also tried his hand at some of the carnival games at the festival, where people also beat the hot sun by gliding on a lubricant-enhanced water slip-and-slide and were then hosed off by members of the New Zealand Fire Service. Opposition leader Phil Goff, Green Party MP Kevin Haig, and Auckland Mayor John Banks also reportedly joined in the celebration. About 8,000 partygoers watched the PM boogie on stage with drag duo Buffy and Bimbo, who also offered him a massage to remember, which Mr. Key politely declined.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 14, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
This is Queer Voices.
One of my favorite community organizations is in the studio tonight. We thought we would bring them on because it's been a while since we've had Legacy Community Health Services on. Eric Rowland and Scott Sawyer are here to talk about Legacy. And this is Brian Levinka, and we have Jack Walensky in the studio tonight. How are y'all guys?
Great. Good morning. Thanks.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
So what's going on? What is Legacy?
Big question.
Big question. We've got to start off with a big question. I mean, there could be people that haven't heard of Legacy.
That's true. Legacy is a community health center offering primary health care services to anyone accepting health insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, sliding scale, all kinds of different services from primary care to eye care to wellness services. And we have a very long history and specialty working with HIV and STDs.
Well, let's talk about eye care since we have Scott Sawyer.
Sure. That's a good idea.
Yes. So you're with the Frost Eye Clinic.
Yeah. In fact, I was the founding kind of medical director of the Frost Eye Clinic when Monty Frost, who died a few years ago, 2 years ago almost exactly, donated the money to open the eye clinic. When the eye clinic opened back in about 1994, CMV retinitis, which is a disease that blinds people, that severely immunosuppressed HIV positive people get, was the number one cause of new blindness in this country in people between the ages of 20 and 60.
Wow.
And people who had no insurance went blind. And so the clinic, at that time it was Montrose Clinic, decided to open up an eye clinic to indigent, uninsured, underinsured people, just to see if we could diagnose the disease early, get it treated, and prevent as much of that blindness as we could.
And how did you do?
We did very well. We picked up lots of cases of new blindness and got started on medication, did lots of screenings. We did a good job.
What kind of medication? How do you deal with that?
At that time, it was really nasty treatment. It was an intravenous, in other words, an IV therapy that was done every day, two or three times a day for the rest of your life. It was really nasty treatment.
Well, I mean, the possibility could be blindness, so I think.
Yeah, so it was bad treatment, but the disease was worse, so people did that. Nowadays, about 6 years ago, there an oral medication came out, a pill that works just as well. And so the treatment now tends to be oral medication rather than IV, which obviously patients do much better.
Incredible advancement.
Much better advancement, yeah.
So in these days where kind of HIV/AIDS is becoming more of a manageable disease, do you still see a lot of people coming in?
We don't see as much of this disease, CMV retinitis, as we used to. The incidence has dropped relatively dramatically when the protease inhibitors came out. It tends to be a disease of people with very low T cells. In other words, people that are very immunocompromised. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, with the really good medications and the dosing schedules that are easier and the decrease in the side effects, we don't see that many people who become that immunologically compromised. Their T cells don't tend to get that low.
Hmm. So what is the future for the Frost Eye Clinic?
Well, we still see CMV retinitis. It tends to be in more of the minority communities, mm-hmm. people who don't think they can be infected, such as Hispanic women, African-American women who, quote, aren't in the at-risk categories, that don't know they're infected until they get sick. And truthfully, that's who we mostly see the disease in right now.
Mm, I see. So you mentioned that legacy, kind of to go back to the scope, is kind of a broadening its mission, I guess.
Yeah, and the Eye Clinic's a perfect example of where it started out. It has this history in the HIV community. It was founded for really people to do screenings for HIV-positive people. Mm-hmm. And out of that, when some of that CMV retinitis went away, we still continued to see people for eye care, but we then started realizing, hey, you know, we've got people who just need glasses, who need contact lenses, so we expanded and started that service. And then we see that people who are not HIV positive but don't have any money or don't have any health insurance to go to an eye doctor in town.
And that's sort of like a secondary thing. I mean, if you're sick and hurting, it's one thing, but eye care is probably not quite up the list for people to really reach out for.
Right. And so many people don't have any kind of health insurance or any way to pay it and can't afford to go into a regular eye doctor. So we offer everything on a sliding scale for those folks who don't have any ability to pay. And that allows us to see a broader population of people.
Right. And it's still considered the community standard of care for HIV-positive people to get their eyes checked once a year, because there are other diseases that can occur. And so we really encourage all our HIV-positive patients, you know, to still continue getting their eyes checked no matter what their T-cells are once a year. So that need continues to be there.
And tell us about where Legacy is, like where the offices are, and how do people, if they were looking for services, how would they go about
it? How do they get started?
Yeah. Sure. We've got actually three locations in Houston. Our main clinic at 215 Westheimer here in the Montrose area, that has the most primary care services. That's where most of our HIV and STD services take place. Mm-hmm. All of our case management for HIV is in that building. And the main number there is 713-830-3000.
And that building pretty much used to be everything of Legacy, but
we've gotten so big that, yeah, we've outgrown it. We certainly have. So we outgrew that and went to a location on 3311 Richmond Avenue, and that houses our eye clinic and our wellness center. Mm-hmm. It's always fun to take people in there because you walk into the back room, and it's a gymnasium. And people are like, wait, this is a nonprofit health clinic? Yeah. And that's how comprehensive we are. We really want to take care of the whole person.
It's the history is Body Positive, which was really its own organization in the 90s. Kind of joined with Legacy Insurance Montrose Clinic probably 10 years ago.
Correct.
8 years ago. And so it's kind of the Body Positive through Montrose Clinic.
So you have this history kind of, but you're at a point where you're evolving and kind of reaching out to the whole community.
Right, that's correct. So much of our history is involved in HIV, which severely impacted gay men, but really didn't have much of an impact on lesbians. And now we probably have more services than we've ever had for lesbians and transgenders. And for those folks who are GLBT and don't have HIV, those folks can come to us for primary health care.
So more of a benefit to the total community instead of the primary HIV.
Correct.
AIDS. Correct.
And how does somebody get started? You just walk into the clinic, or you try to set up appointments?
You can walk into the clinic. It's probably easiest if you make an appointment ahead of time by calling our main number again, 713-830-3000. And they come in, and it depends on what service they want. Depends on, you know, if they are HIV, they go into a different sort of, fill out different forms and go see a different person than if they are having health insurance, for example, and want to use Medicaid, for example.
So you can actually start there. You don't have to go to another organization and
Nope. You can start with us and get set up as a patient and then come and see all of our different services from, you know, primary health care to a psychiatry to counseling to our wellness center, our nutritionist, and our personal trainers.
And how does the pay scale work?
The pay scale is really dependent on that person's income. So it's we look at their income. We ask them for a couple of paycheck stubs or some other proof of income. We look at that, and then we base a fee on what their income is.
Now, how do you cover the rest of the... How do you subsidize that?
That is all subsidized through the federal government. We are a federally qualified health center, which means we receive funding from the federal government to help people who have no ability to pay for health care.
Very good. Well, I've heard talk in the community, and I wanted to talk about it tonight. I've heard that maybe Legacy is moving more towards a general health care facility and kind of moving away from the GOBT community. And I wanted, you know, like the rumor is that the Legacy, the swirl at the bottom is now blue because there's no rainbow at Legacy. And, you know, that's kind of what I've heard. And I wanted to have you on to talk about that.
Yeah, that's interesting because our logo never had a rainbow in it until we became Legacy. And then all of a sudden, you know, people greatly miss the rainbow.
Yeah.
I think the fact is that we see everyone, so we really truly see the rainbow of people.
But not to exclude the GLBT community.
But not to exclude the GLBT community, certainly okay. Not. You know, one thing that I've had this question asked to me before, and people were like, "Hey, you're kind of moving away from the gay community," and my response to that is that I've been working as a gay rights advocate since I was in my 20s, and my goal was always for us to be a part of the group. Same with the whole gay marriage issue. I think we want to have marriage instead of civil unions.
Yeah.
So that we're a part of accepted of general society. And one thing that I think about is that we've been able, as a gay-started clinic, to serve that community so well that we can now go out and serve other communities who are disenfranchised, who don't have access to health care, and who get judgment when they go to the doctor's office.
Right.
Well, basically, the Montrose Clinic started as just an STD clinic.
That's correct.
And you've pretty much expanded to almost the whole gamut of health care.
That's correct. And with that ability to see more people and see all of the GLBT community.
Yeah, and if you follow the, which I'm sure you know, as you look at who is getting HIV infected. It's not the gay and lesbian community. I mean, we still have a lot of conversions, but the disease is actually growing in the minority communities,
mm-hmm.
in the Hispanic community and the Black community,
right.
that aren't gay. And in fact, the men don't consider themselves gay. They're men having sex with men.
And
they don't want to be considered gay because that brings up a whole nother set
cultural
of
stereotypes.
Issues.
Right.
So you're kind of expanding. There is also talk that you're moving into a new building.
We will at some point, as Jack pointed out earlier, that the Westheimer Clinic used to house all of our clinic, all
right.
of our services, and we've outgrown that one and moved into 3311 Richmond. We now have a satellite location in the 5th Ward of Houston, which is north east Houston.
Is that the Lyons location?
That's the Lyons Avenue location. That location will remain out there to mm-hmm. serve that community. And but eventually, yeah, we're in the next few years, we will merge our buildings, our 3311 Richmond building and our 215 Westheimer building, into one central location here in the Montrose area.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Make it easier for patients to be able to come see their... Right now, we have nutrition in the 3311 building.
Mm-hmm.
But primary care is in our Westheimer building, and for our diabetic patients and our patients who have wasting syndromes, the mechanics of kind of seeing the nutritionist and seeing the primary care doctor gets a little difficult.
Yeah.
There's just no room. We are, there's just no more room in the Westheimer.
Especially location. For people who don't have vehicles.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, granted, both places are on bus stops, but it's still, it's a hassle.
It is. And it's a luxury to kind of move into one building. And I know that y'all are capital campaigning for that.
Yes, we are. We are. Trying to raise the funds to
get
all
that
taken care of.
I mean, I think all nonprofits are feeling the crunch of the economy.
Most definitely. We're definitely feeling the crunch.
So in terms of what events do you have throughout the year kind of for Legacy?
Well, in January we had a brand new event for Legacy. It's called Cabaret for a Cure. Mm-hmm. And this was our first year of being the beneficiary for it. And it was a fantastic event at the Hilton Americas mm-hmm. in downtown Houston. Had a whole array of cabaret-style jazz yes. performers. We had a great, great turnout and raised over $250,000.
Holy cow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Paul David Venata.
Yeah, and that's his baby.
Is a big fan of ours, and that helps.
Yeah. What else?
We've also got, we'll have a luncheon this fall. We had one in October of this year. Mm-hmm. It was actually delayed by Hurricane Ike. So we had some craziness with that. But we had that, and we did hold true and got that done in October, and we'll have another one this fall. We're looking at doing something different for our gala this year. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of waiting to figure out exactly how we're going to do that, really kind of in response to the tough economic times.
Yeah, it's very tough. Was there anything else that we need to talk about from Legacy? Anything else you want our listeners to know?
Well, we're getting ready to do some, we've got a brand new PSA running on TV right now. It's on Comcast Cable, uh-huh. and it's a message to, an HIV prevention message to Hispanic parents,
huh.
To really talk to their kids about STDs and HIV and protecting themselves against those diseases. And you can catch that on various different Comcast cable channels. There'll also be a link to it on our website.
Oh, good segue. What's your website address?
www.legacycommunityhealth.org.
And give us the phone number.
713-830-3000.
Thank you very much. We had Eric Rowland and Scott Sawyer from Legacy Community Health Services. And this is Brian Levinka and Jack Walensky. Thank you.
Thanks,
Brian. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Thank you.
When I'm feeling lonely, someone telephone me. It's getting hard to pass the time. So take me out of dying. Watch me while I'm flying. Baby, it's a waste of time. So say that you will find him. Creep on up behind him. I'm moving around the town all day. Well, I'm underestimated. Highly underrated. Can there be another way? Somebody tell me, say to me or tell me, direct me on which way to go. I know I look delicious, I'm only nutritious, I work out 7 times a day. Well, you think that's kind of tragic, but that Tina works her magic, cause I haven't had a fight all day. And goes without demanding. They're all looking cause he's trying to hide. If I could just impress him, let me take him home, undress him. He'd be sleeping here right by my side.
I need a man, perhaps a man like you. I need a man to make my dreams come true. Come true. I need a man.
2007, and an unreleased dance mix. That was Richard LaCoury, I Need a Man. This is Queer Voices. And Jennifer, we've got just a moment here. I wanted to mention that I heard an interesting program on the radio Sunday morning.
Oh, really? What was it about?
On the PBS channel. It was about 2 7-year-old transgender kids.
Seven years old. Yeah,
yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I heard about that. What do you remember about the interview?
Well, it was very interesting. It was the one that they were sort of focused on was transgendered male to female. And the backstory was interesting. The mother had a son already and was praying to God for a daughter. The ultrasound showed that she was going to have another son, but she kept praying for a daughter. And so then when the son was born and was from an early age showing these transgender characteristics, mm-hmm. she started blaming herself.
Mm-hmm. She was blessed with a daughter.
She thought that she did it, you know. So yeah.
All right.
But it was a really interesting piece, and it was very interesting that the 7-year-old kid was wise way beyond her years.
Most of us know, at that age, 5 to 7 years old, we know that we're different. I mean, it's because about that time is when society starts stereotyping us. You know, little boys don't do this, little girls don't do that. And I related a story of before. That was the way it was when my mother related the story, how that when they sent me out, before they sent me off to kindergarten, they informed me what little boys did and what little boys did not do. And most of it was a whole bunch of list of things that little boys don't do that either. Little. So,
and you wanted to carry a purse.
Oh, yeah. What can I say?
Well, we have a little FCC requirement to do here. And,
yeah,
so
what is it?
We're going to be, who are we coming back to?
We're coming back to the Bayou City Boys Club.
All right. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Well, in Texas, it's starting to get a little bit warmer, and so it's starting to feel like spring to me. It's warm in here. And spring brings a lot of fundraising activities
to Houston.
I think
it's the hot boys in here. Oh, I'm sorry.
No comment. Spring has a lot of activities in Houston, a lot of fundraising activities,
especially during
Easter, and one of which I'm kind of familiar with, is the Jungle Party. And joining us in the studios tonight are the Jungle 17 co-chairs. Parker Langley, Josh Combs, and Scott Thomason.
Welcome, you guys.
Hello.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Boys, tell us about Jungle. What is Jungle for people that have never heard?
Well, Jungle is a very fun party that is during the Easter holidays. It actually started... Oh, I'm sorry, I thought I was beating on the table. It actually started a number of years ago. Actually, this is 17, so...
17 years ago.
And when a group of guys that were all turning 30 decided to have a joint birthday party, and instead of gifts, they wanted to have cash donations, and they were going to give it away to some area HIV organization here in Houston.
And that's because at the time HIV was devastating the community.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
People rose up and decided that they wanted to get active and kind of contribute. So here we are 17 years later. We've done Jungle every year on Easter. When is it exactly?
This year?
Yes.
It is April 11th.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that day?
That was not a trick question.
Is that a trick question?
Honestly, you know. Is there any cosmic significance to the 11th?
It's always the Saturday before
Easter. The Saturday before Easter,
right. Didn't mean to throw you there.
Well.
I was trying to help you.
Now, for people that haven't attended Jungle,
of you on streaming video, you saw that.
Yes. No. what can people expect at Jungle? What would someone for the first time
expect to see?
They can expect a fun party when they come. The venue will be Warehouse Live, which is at 813 St. Emmanuel.
And that's on the east side of downtown?
That is the east side of town, on the other side of the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And it's a local favorite, and lots of hot guys, lots of southern friendliness.
Okay, but we invite women, too, not just...
Of course, women are always accepted.
Right.
And...
Well, thanks.
And welcome.
And our trans people, too.
Absolutely.
Yes. Right. But just expect a really fun party, and to get back to the community, the ticket proceeds that will go to our beneficiaries.
And do you know the beneficiaries offhand?
Yes, they are... this year for Jungle 17 is beneficiaries are AIDS Foundation Houston, Bering Omega Community Services, Casa de Esperanza de Los Niños, Lazarus House, and Resurrection MCC.
I see. And how much does Jungle typically raise?
On average, the past few years, we've been averaging about, I'd say, $45,000 to $47,000 each year.
That's terrific.
For just one night.
Congratulations.
Very good. And so is it a single event, or are there multiple events?
There are actually multiple events this year. This year we actually have a full weekend lineup, starting on Thursday, April 9th, running through Sunday, April 12th. Thursday, April 9th, we have our Jungle Meet and Greet, which will be at Meteor, and that will be from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. And then Friday, April 10th, is the opening party at South Beach, from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Mm. And then, of course, the main event, Jungle 17, the hunt is on, is what we've themed our party this year.
And what exactly are we hunting for?
That is your call.
Money. Money, Brian.
Oh, good answer.
We need lots of money.
Okay,
and
good.
May I take a moment to give a little shout-out to my honey downstairs? Hello, Burke.
Oh, Bert.
Oh.
They're such a cute couple. Okay, we digress. Okay, so... The hunt is on is the main part.
The hunt is on is Jungle 17. That's the theme for the party. That's April 11th at Warehouse Live from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. And then the after-hours event, which will be held at Venue, which is on the new location on Main Street, from 3 a.m. to 10 a.m. And then our closing party will be held again at the legendary Rich's Houston, which is from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m.
What a diverse selection of events. So there's now, if you could possibly attend all of them, I mean, your dance card would be full.
Very full.
Kurt.
Now, so do we have a lot of people that attend this from out of town? I mean...
Basically, it is a very localized party. We love to see people from out of town, but mostly it's a Houston party.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of thing, what do you wear? Something like this.
Well,
that's one of those things that girls like to know about.
And the boys.
But
jungle prints.
It's all about
jungle prints.
Jungle prints.
It's all about getting the outfit ready.
And,
we see a lot of different jungle things.
Well,
jungle.
Like what?
Like little grass skirts, little like Tarzan outfits. And we encourage that. I say we because I'm part of Bayou City Boys Club. So.
Oh, okay. I was wondering. I didn't know.
I'm kind of interviewing, you know, asking questions I know the answer to. So.
I have four people in here, and they're all answering the questions. No, seriously, you know, somebody out there that's just now hearing about this, maybe someone who's new to Houston, comes in and they hear about this, and what's it going to be like?
You know what? It's going to be a lot of fun. And you know what? We want people to come who have never been to Jungle. We want you to enjoy just the whole experience. Come comfortable. Tennis shoes, jeans, t-shirts, preferably not on. But, you know, we want you to have a really good time. It's going to be, there's a lot of people that are...
I think I'll keep my t-shirt on.
You're going to keep it on? No,
yes,
I think you would look really great with it off. A little bikini.
Well, I could do that.
Now, Parker, that's...
Well...
We won't talk about your outfit.
Oh. I could get my red latex out.
Beautiful.
Well, that'd be a little warm, though, for this time of year.
Yeah. And last year it rained, so it was kind of...
It did rain. It did rain. Yeah, sometimes the weather's very kind to us, and
now,
sometimes
is there,
not so kind.
Is there a website that people could go to and find out more information?
Our website is www.junglehouston.com. That's JUNGLEHOUSTON.com.
And are there other events that BCBC does throughout the year? Absolutely, Brian.
Well, tell us, Parker.
Well, this year we brought back a hurricane party.
Oh, that was...
Hurricane party was big in the 90s when they actually... it was a junior version of the jungle, so it was a dance party at night. And what we did this year is we moved it to Sunday afternoon, basically poolside. Unfortunately, this year we actually had a hurricane that
I think it was a premonition. I think
right
because we had the hurricane.
Right,
we had
clever of y'all.
Very clever.
It
just happened
like
to be during hurricane season. But you know, it turned out great, and we were able to give quite a bit of money away to an organization that you know is very deserving.
Good for you. That's yeah. good. You know. Stuff that, like that happens, but it's, you know, it takes a real trooper to keep on going.
Well, you know, that's why we're here. We want to give away money. That's what we're doing. We're working for extremely deserving organizations that need money. And that's, you know, that's what we're here to do.
That's a good point because, you know, the economy is starting to
Yeah, it shrinks right now.
You know, everyone is trying to raise money and people aren't just giving money, so it's kind of it makes the fundraising that much harder.
You know, we want whatever somebody can give.
And all of the theme are the different parties have the same theme to it? It's just one theme runs through the whole
For the Jungle Weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Jungle Weekend, and so basically it has to do with it's themed for jungle. So this year we came up with the Hunt Is On. So I'm sure we'll have some crazy themes.
So if you are a bit shy and still want to come out and really enjoy yourself, you've got a hell of a lot of stuff to learn.
Oh, really? I thought that was one of the first. Mm-hmm.
Stuff to look at.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Even for somebody that's never been to one of our parties, you're going to have a good time. And you know what? You don't even have to know anybody there because chances are, by the time you get there, people are so friendly. You're going to feel like you've known these people quite a long time.
And about how many people usually come to?
Usually we have about 1,000 to 1,200 people show up on the Saturday night event.
Mm-hmm.
And then Warehouse Live is actually split up into three rooms. So it's basically, well, this year it's now three rooms. So we have extra space so we can actually take more people than what we have in the past. So anybody and everybody show up.
And we are praying for good weather this year.
Yes. So let's talk about the jungle origin. Where did it get its name? How did it start?
Before my time.
Not before your time.
Why do you keep asking these trick questions?
These are trick questions. Well, the Jungle Party came from the original location, as I understand it.
You're right, Brian. And it was... Go ahead.
I'm trying to interview you.
Oh, it's okay.
Brian, tell us about the origin of it.
That's what I was gonna
well,
say.
It was originally held at Spencer Warehouse in East Houston, which is like a plant kind of...
Plant warehouse.
Warehouse. And so, to decorate... Why not have a jungle party? So they had all the plants and everything, so it just kind of was natural, and that stuck. And so here we are 17 years later, still with the jungle. So it's jungle in name, and we kind of decorate, but... You know.
Oh. Well, I was wondering about that. Jungle meaning wild. And
oh, it's wild.
It is wild.
Get down.
Oh, you get down.
Oh. Okay.
Okay, so let's talk about maybe if people are out there and they want to get involved, what can they do? Can they... Join the organization? How does that work?
I'm answering all of them. Yes, absolutely, you can get involved. BCBC is a fantastic organization to belong to. I was the president at one point in time, and I can honestly say I'm very proud of what we've done and what we're doing. The organization has what's called an associate membership. And you come to a general meeting, meetings are actually we have a meeting this Thursday at 7:30.
As Scott writes that down.
No, right as he writes it down in front of me. It is at AIDS Foundation Houston and this Thursday, April the 19th at 7:30. Thanks, Scott.
Welcome. And where is that? For somebody that might not know.
It's 3202 Westland.
Okay. How do you know where it is, Josh?
I work there.
he's a little worker bee there.
Oh.
It's a Westland and Richmond kind of area. Neighborhood.
But in order to be an associate member, you have to require a year obligation to do a couple of things with the organization. And it actually takes you through what we do in a year. We have a couple of parties. we are actually in our biggest fundraiser of the year, which is Jungle. From here, we will go to, I'm trying to think, I guess it would be our hurricane party, then it would be our holiday party, mm-hmm. and...
You're not playing a hurricane this year, are you?
I'm hoping not, you know, we'll see what happens.
Just in name.
It's during hurricane season, okay. and it's kind of where, you know, it's a playoff. That. But, and then sometimes we have a theater night. It just kind of depends. We don't really want the members to have to work too much and to put on so many events that they're just tired and they don't want to do stuff. You want it to be a lot of fun.
And doesn't BCBC participate in the Pride Parade?
We absolutely participate in the Pride Parade, and we were very lucky to win...
We won the Best Overall Spirit of Montrose Award this year for the Pride Parade.
Whoa, that's a good
thing.
Yeah, so it's pretty awesome, you know.
I was one of the judges.
Oh, well, that's why.
That's why that question came up.
That's a good question.
Okay. What else? Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say that I have heard about the Jungle Party for years, and... when I was first coming out, I went to one. And it is a wild party, you guys. And if you want to go have a good time, you know, you enjoy and get into the spirit as much as you want to. And that's what's really good. It's safe. And, you know, you're secure. You can come out and just do whatever you want to. And it's a good, safe place to have a good time.
And the money... goes to a good cause and to some good people.
Yeah, do y'all have any sponsors for this? I mean, do y'all get commercial sponsors or to donate big bucks to you?
Good question, Jennifer.
Well, if there's anybody out there that wants to sponsor,
we'd
love that.
Let's talk about that. We have corporate sponsors and we also have underwriters. And I know the goal every year is to completely pay for the party.
Yeah, usually in years past, the party's usually been paid for in full. At the latest, usually a week before the party. Sometimes we've got it paid for earlier than that. But it's always been paid for by the Saturday, the main event. So this year our goal is to raise $60,000 for our beneficiaries. And hopefully that will come through, as it always has in the past. And
that's what we're asking maybe our listeners that want to support a great cause for a great charities in Houston, that maybe they can... go to the website and contact a member and become either a sponsor or an underwriter.
We're also having an underwriter event at Meteor on Sunday, March 8th. I think it's from 2 to 5 or 3 to 6. So by Meteor.
That would be a good time to kind of maybe come out and learn more about BCBC in general.
Absolutely.
To get involved and to put money towards a good cause. I mean, I know it's getting hard to raise money, and that's a lofty goal for BCBC in Jungle, but I believe in setting goals high.
And yeah, we are we're the last few original, what you want to quote, themed circuit parties of the United States. There's only about six of us left that are all nonprofit organizations that were out there to, you know, the reason why circuit parties were invented was to raise money for HIV/AIDS. And now there's only just a handful of us left that have survived, and so we'd like to keep it going with, you know, this party. So,
Is there anything we've missed? Anything you want to cover?
Well, let's give the date for the
event. For the event again.
It's Saturday, April 11th, from 10 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Warehouse Live. 4 a.m. I'm sorry.
Right, and if you get there and they're not there, you're either early or late.
Right.
And that's it's 813 St. Emmanuel Street.
And there's a website?
Website is www.junglehouston.com. It's all one word.
I want to thank all of you.
Yes.
Well, thanks for having
Parker,
us.
Parker, Josh, and Scott, thank you. I'm looking forward to the event, as I always do. And hopefully some of our listeners will come out and check it out if they
Absolutely.
Haven't been before.
That's it. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
The latest album by Jennifer O'Connor is called Here With Me, and we're glad you're here with us. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile.
Misery loves the cruel way that you speak to yourself. And I love the cool way you look at me. And we've got a lot of time to get this right. At least that's how I...
This is O'Connor's fourth album, and it's a bittersweet exploration of love and loss.
New album Here With Me is mostly about me kind of coming to terms with some losses, trying to develop more optimistic and positive outlook, and simultaneously having the benefit of being in a new romantic relationship.
You said this way for all your years. Checking numbers and regarding fears. I can see you try.
Find out more about the album Here With Me at www.jenniferoconnor.net. And O'Connor is O-C-O-N-N-O-R.
You don't know what it's like. There's no holding hands. Out in the streets it's the same all across these lands. Wish I were the captain on this sinking ship of food. And anyway, who made these rules? I want the world to change just for me. And I want it all so selfishly. I want it to be all I can be. Because I can be great. Because I can be great, 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 because I can be great.
In the 90s, Jeff Heisko was lead singer of the Judy Bats, and now he's released his second album as a band, just called Heisko. The album's intriguing title is Clip-On Nose Ring.
Clip-On Nose Ring is me, Jeff Heisko, writing my own songs for the first time, musings on some tentative relationships between men, some of them broken relationships, some joyous, some of them with men that are very well fed, and there's also one song on there that is about a girl from my past.
You're the best broken dream I ever had, a little happy and the best broken dream I ever had, a little good night and a big old bang.
You can get more information about Jeff Heisko and his album Clip-On Nose Ring at www.heiskomusic.com. That's www.heiskellmusic.com.
The song is called Dilemma, but its hit video was not one for Captain Magic and his debut album, Young, Gay, and Proud.
I'm sorry, Dad, if you can't understand it, don't be mad, I'm in love with a man. How can something so wrong feel so right? It's been so long, my whole damn life. Listen to the song that I write tonight. This is a love that I just can't fight. This is the hardest thing I've had to do. For once in my life, I'm gonna tell the truth. What more can I say? I'm gay, that's the way I am. Ever since a little kid playing with my friends. If I burn in hell, oh well, amen.
Captain Magic has been doing rap music for a number of years with some success, but only recently decided the real way to happiness was to accept himself as a gay man.
The new album is called Young, Gay, and Proud. It's 12 tracks of hip-hop. It runs the gamut from comedy to political activism to coming out. The main reason why I wrote the album was to break down the stereotypes and to empower the younger people in the gay community.
Even got the queens straight from disco. Got them all dancing from Greenwich to Frisco. Latino slave, papi chulo loco. Number one homo, a logo, let's go. Let me hear it loud, young, gay, and proud. Stand up for your rights, everybody get down. Let me hear it loud, young, gay, and proud. Stand up for our rights and we march to the sound. Let me hear it loud, young, gay, and proud. Stand up for your rights, everybody.
we're loud, drunk and proud. Standing for our rights and we march to the sound. A new generation, we've taken our rights.
Find out more about the CD Young, Gay, and Proud at www.captainmagic.com. And because there are so many other Captain Magics on the internet, he spells magic M-A-G-I-K.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trento. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
Let me hear it loud. Don't care, proud. Stand up for your rights. Everybody get down. Let me hear it loud. Don't care, proud. Stand up for our rights. And we march to the sound. Let me hear it loud. Don't care, proud. Young, gay, and proud. Young, gay, and proud.
This is Queer Voices.
A couple of years ago, there was a movie that came out that was very relevant to the GLBT community. It was called For the Bible Tells Me So, and it kind of had a religious tie-in to it, kind of talking about the religion's point of view. In the studio tonight, we have Karen Kamen, who is the board secretary and chair of the Welcoming Committee for the Unitarian Universalist Church, Northwoods in the Woodlands. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here tonight.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah.
Now, you're in the Woodlands, which is a conservative part of town. How are things out there, and how's your congregation?
Well, Unitarian Universalism is a fairly liberal congregation, or denomination, so our congregation actually voted to be a welcoming congregation committee, or church. So this is a covenantal thing at our church.
Mm-hmm.
So within our church, we have a lot of support. Within the community, I don't know how well known we are. We're working on that.
And that's why we're here tonight, to let our listeners know. Now, tell us about your event that's coming up.
Well, For the Bible Tells Me So is a documentary that looks at five different families, including the family of Speaker Dick Gephardt, our former Speaker Dick Gephardt,
mm-hmm.
and the family of Bishop Eugene Robinson. They're all Christian families, which all struggled in one way or another with kids coming out. It's a wonderful, and it's also intermixed with the families. There's commentary from religious leaders and scholars. It's a wonderful movie about acceptance, and it really speaks to anybody who's struggling with the issues of religion and homosexuality, whether from a very conservative perspective or from a more liberal perspective, trying to get through to somebody who's more conservative.
Very good. So how do you do that?
You'll have to come see the movie.
I've seen the movie, several times. As a matter of fact, I got a screening of it here. They sent it to us. One thing about it is I really enjoyed it because it's an excellent portrayal of everybody in the inner workings in the family, and with the Gephardts, they were very good about that. But there's a couple other people who had some difficulty. One was a minister's family. And in dealing with that, and really, the Bible's teachings in your face, or the misreading of the Bible's teachings in your face, maybe a better way of putting that, because I found that problem to be universal in a lot of congregations, but it seems like a lot of the congregations are getting a little more understanding, and it's great to have your congregation to vote to be affirming. That's great.
And what does that mean exactly, to be a welcoming congregation?
Well, a welcoming congregation is a congregation. All Unitarian Universalist churches are open to anybody.
Okay.
A welcoming congregation has gone through special training.
Oh.
Not just the committee, but the congregation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And made a commitment to be inclusive and to do outreach and to be inclusive at all levels of worship and social activities at the church, from language to social events to commitment ceremonies.
Excellent. And now, is there a reason that you're becoming welcoming out in the Woodlands or Montgomery County?
Well, it's been a welcoming congregation since May of 2003, and mm-hmm. I've only been at the church for the past 3 or 4 years, 3 and a half. To be honest, I think all UU churches should be welcoming congregations, wow, because it speaks to one of our primary principles and purposes, which is that we affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every human being.
That's great. Now, I heard a statistic that the suicide rate was higher in Montgomery County.
You know, I don't have a confirmed source for that, but we're told unofficially that it's roughly twice what it is in the Houston area. And also,
do you think it's because they're conservative?
Well, honestly, I think that is an issue.
Mental deficiency?
No, but I do think that conservative families, well, not officially anyway, I do think that, that conservative families do have an impact on what happens to teens. And the last issue of the Journal of American Pediatrics Association came out with a study that says that GLBT teens are more than eight times as likely to commit suicide or try to commit suicide if their families are rejecting, mm-hmm, than if they're accepting.
And if their spiritual side is rejecting them also, and they get a lot of that, you know, gobbledygook damnation stuff, that it in fact leads to suicide. I mean, that there's either that or drug abuse, a lot of bad things you can do to yourself, and it all has to do with a lack of self-worth that's been given to them by their families and their churches, and it's just horrendous that what goes on. And then at schools they get bullied, so that's a whole different story.
Absolutely. And churches which have a literalist interpretation of the Bible and believe that there's something wrong with being gay and tell kids that are somehow not realizing that everybody has spiritual needs.
Mm-hmm. I always ask them, do they not eat shrimp either?
Good question.
Or those women wearing pants?
They're mixing the cotton and the polyester.
Yes.
And they don't stone their children for disobedience, which
right,
they're supposed to
That's
do.
That's right. Well, yeah, if they did that, there'd be fewer of them.
And I think that's the message.
One generation and they'd all be gone.
Right. I think that's the message of the movie, is tolerance and kind of maybe understanding what the Bible says and not being such a literal translation and, you know, kind of getting the message, the true message, I think, that, you know, maybe is not being interpreted sometimes.
Absolutely. And the movie recognizes something that I think it can be hard for, well, honestly, for people like me who are fairly liberal to realize, which is that there are people of good conscience who believe what they've been told, who are really struggling with their hearts versus what they're told at church. And we will be having a discussion after the movie.
Oh, okay.
Led by our minister, and also the pastor from a local Lutheran church will be there.
Well, let's give a shout out to those. Who will those people be?
Reverend Ellen Cooper Davis,
uh-huh,
and Pastor Beth Halverson. I want to say it's Lord of Life Lutheran, but don't hold me to that.
I think that what I found in the movie was the message was love. That, you know, that transcends it all. I mean, your child, no matter what they may be, you know, love them. You know, you are responsible. They're God's gift to you, and you're rejecting a gift from God. Somehow that just doesn't work in my head, you know. And I consider myself a very spiritual person, and that just doesn't fit. But I hear that all the time from the people we won't name, but you've met them on the streets.
It's interesting how judgmental some people are.
Yeah, and I don't understand that. It's just, I guess they come from a different planet.
And, of course, they don't all realize, truly don't realize, that they know people in this situation. It's easy for them to judge, mm-hmm, people they see as other and not one of us.
Right.
But of course, what, 3 in 20 are at their church?
Well, and I think that you go to a whole different level when you talk about trans people, because, you know, most of us just sort of blend in. Very few trans people stand up and say, "Hey, I'm trans." Most of them just want to blend into the environment, and on any given day, people run across or interact with a trans person and never know it. And so that's a whole different... But
I mean, we're still trying to even get trans people incorporated into the GLBT community. There's still some resistance there.
So
that's a long road.
I think it's very important what y'all are doing. The work you're doing as far as affirming and welcoming congregations, I honor you for that and acknowledge the great effort it takes to open yourself up to learn something new if you don't already know. Enlightenment, you know, is one thing that everyone has needs and seeks, but yet some of us still close our minds to the truth. But thank you. I want to pray.
Well, let's talk about
tell us more about some stuff.
Well, let's talk about the event and where it's going to be and the address and give us the basic details.
It will be February 27th at Northwoods Unitarian Universalist Church at 1370 North Mill Bend in the Woodlands.
Mm-hmm.
People who want information about the event can go to the church's website, www.northwoodsuu.org.
Mm-hmm.
There's a link there to the movie flyer. If you want to know more about the movie, you can also go to www.forthebibletellsmeso.org.
Very good. And are there... tickets, or do you just kind of show up, or how?
It is free. Mm-hmm. We're accepting donations, but it's free, and there will be child care provided.
I see. So, a free movie. And this, February 27th, is that a Friday?
Friday.
So, a nice Friday evening. Go take the family, see something special. The discussions afterwards, people will be able to ask the questions they really want to know after seeing it.
Yes, it's important to us that we create a safe space for people to bring up any issues that are close to their hearts, talk about their personal experiences. And we will have two members of the clergy there leading the discussion, there to answer the tough questions. And more than anything, to listen, I think.
Are there, it's welcome to everyone, to the young people too, if they want to be there.
You know, absolutely.
I'm thinking of possibly, you know, kids that may come from homes like we were talking about a moment ago. They want to slip off and go and come and see and actually listen to the way things are with other people. When they're closed in their own environment, sometimes it's too closed and they don't see the outside world as being different.
And sometimes it's important to get the message out that there are adults and religious people and straight people out there who have no problem with who they are. And, in fact, our minister has designated her office as a safe place.
Hmm. Oh, that's good. You know, that is very good because in my growing up, that was not the case.
That's a story we hear altogether too
mm-hmm.
often.
Yeah, I think... things are starting, society is becoming more accepting, but there are still pockets of conservative, very anti-GLBT feelings.
Kingwood?
I mean, I think...
the People's Republic?
I think the whole, most of Houston is surrounded by conservative, you know, kind of the band, I call it the band of red around the big pile of blue in the middle.
Yes. Well, we're certainly in a conservative area, but we're not the only church out there. There's the United Church of Christ has an open and affirming congregation in Spring.
And not all the homosexuals live in Montrose. I mean, we're everywhere throughout the greater metropolitan area.
We're everywhere?
We're everywhere.
I understand even some rural communities.
Yes.
Well, I am from a rural community, and I grew up literally thinking I was the only one.
Oh, how awful.
And I go to A&M, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I will be the only homosexual at A&M. And then, oh, my God. A&M is very gay.
Why with your surprise?
Yes. So I think the message and the point is that you're showing this movie in the Woodlands to kind of bring in these potential people that have issues with the condemnation that they may feel from, you know, the right-wing Christian organization.
Yes. Well, and also people who may feel that they do not want to be condemning, but they're struggling with having been told they have to be.
Absolutely. That's a good point.
Good, very good point. Have you got any pushback from the community?
Not so far, except for being told that we couldn't put our flyer up in a local library because it was religious in nature, although there were other things on them that were from Christian groups.
Interesting.
It just wasn't their approved religion?
Their official policy is no religion. We're working on that one.
Oh. Well, you know, there is that comment that one religion's not the same as the other religion.
Well, we are the uncommon denomination, they say, so apparently we're not the...
I like that. You are.
The uncommon denomination. Very good. So.
And anything we've missed, I want to give you plenty of opportunity to cover anything that we still have.
How did you get started with the university, with the church?
Well, I went to a local church that was, it was Gene Robinson's denomination. Uh-huh. I don't want to name the church.
Right.
And that was one of the reasons I went, was because of Gene Robinson. Mm-hmm. And that day, the minister happened to preach about how he would never ordain a gay priest and never marry a gay couple. And I sat in church and cried.
Oh, yeah.
Walked out the door. Got on the web, and people had been telling me for years I should go to a Unitarian church. And I found the local one, and there on the web page it said they were a welcoming, proud to be a welcoming congregation.
Mm-hmm.
So the next Sunday there I was, and I've never left.
Wow. And so you've become so impassioned with the cause that you're kind of, you're out there leading the way.
Well, it's sort of always been an important cause to me, and that's mm-hmm. why I chose Northwoods. But, yeah, I think we have a wonderful committee where we've got lots of big plans.
Well, tell us about some of the plans.
Well, we like to do a movie quarterly.
Uh-huh.
We certainly have a big presence at the Pride Parade.
Oh.
And it's our dream. I don't know whether we can make it happen this year, but it's our dream that someday we can put on an alternative prom in Montgomery County.
Oh, how wonderful. So let us know.
We will
put it out there to everyone.
Yeah.
That is great.
It needs doing.
I mean, it's definitely a segment of the population that, you know, maybe is underserved out there.
Yes, and someday we would love it if we could work out something similar to Hatch mm-hmm. in the area.
Hatch North.
Yes.
North Hatch. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you for coming, and...
And what? They're trying to segue me into something.
Segue you into something, saying good night to these wonderful people.
Oh, well, thank you for coming. I mean,
we have more coming up from this way out. How's that for a segue?
Yeah, that's a great segue. And
Karen,
again, the time and date again, real quickly.
February 27th, 7 p.m.
Yes.
Thank you very
Karen
much.
Karen Kamen, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for letting us
and
join you.
And this is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Scenes from Life of the Absurd with playwright who's gay, Edward Albee. Later in the program.
The church is on fire.
LGBT Catholics and their liberal compatriots have had plenty of bad news in recent weeks. The latest rash of insults began with Pope Benedict XVI's Christmas message, in which he compared lesbian-gay equality and gender rights to environmental degradation. Shortly thereafter, the pontiff revoked the excommunication of an illegitimately ordained bishop who denies that there was a Holocaust, and promoted to bishop a priest who proclaimed that Hurricane Katrina was divine retribution on LGBT-friendly New Orleans. Now the spotlight has fallen on the South Brisbane, Australia congregation of St. Mary's, where Archbishop John Battersby has fired progressive parish priest Peter Kennedy. Among Father Kennedy's sins are allowing lay people, including women, to preach and cultivating a community that openly welcomes lesbians and gays. This Way Out correspondent Mark Jeffrey commiserated with St. Mary's Community Council gay and lesbian representative Vince Gannout.
The bishop's letter actually had the removal of Peter Kennedy as one of six items. The rest of the items also reflect on the gay and lesbian community to the extent that they're removing the 6:30 p.m. Mass on a Saturday evening and also the 5 p.m. on the Sunday evening, which is the one where the majority of gays and lesbians would attend.
Mm.
So unless they're prepared to go under this new arrangement to a 7 a.m. Mass or a 9 a.m. Mass, that there won't be a facility for them for Mass on a Sunday.
I mean, the gay and lesbian community at St. Mary's is quite broad and involved in pretty well all the services and pretty well every part of the church. That hasn't really been mentioned at all in the Archbishop's correspondence, but it seems to be a smack in the teeth.
Well, we are afraid. There's no question about that. But where our concern lies is the gays and lesbians, to a large extent, have been abused or felt abused or felt unwanted by the Catholic Church in the past. And they have now found the Catholic faith again. And they love it there, they feel welcome, and they feel as if they're now Catholics alive again.
Mm.
And we want to maintain that loving circumstance for those people. That they feel affirmed, they feel human, they feel loved at that time. So we need to preserve that.
It's a very safe space to be. A few years ago, there was a guy that I met who was over from Canada studying for a while, and And he was also a guy with a strong sense of spirituality. We went to St. Mary's several times, and even towards the end of the time, I was able to be there at the Mass, take communion, sing, and you know, with my arm around him and tears rolling down my cheeks, and it was no one batted an eyelid.
No, no. And you'll get somebody who might even come up and say, hey, it's okay to be gay, and you'll think, oh, this person's gay, where in fact, no, he's a husband, middle-aged or even late 30s, with children, and he just, we are all members of the community. One of the great watersheds of coming out for those people who do come out is the sense of freedom, and you get that at St. Mary's. St. Mary's is on the resource books of quite a few doctors and psychologists around Brisbane, where people who do have sexuality problems, particularly at the gay and lesbian area, they quite often will get recommended, pop along to St. Mary's 5 o'clock Mass and just see how you go.
So we don't really know what's going to happen come February 21. You've just come from a meeting of the steering committee there, which we won't go into the details of that. That'll all unfold in the next week or two.
A particular topic of tonight's meeting was how we are going to address the issues for the gays and lesbians, how we're going to look after them. We are considering just actually a direct approach to the proposed new administrator to say, hey, this is our situation. How are you going to address it? This is how we'd like you to address it. This is how we can work with you to address it, to maintain this connection with these people. How that person addresses it himself and responds, we don't know. The Gay and Lesbian Choir practice area for Tuesday night, what arrangements are going to take place? Are they going to continue? What changes would be needed? But we still have to look for and on behalf of the Gay and Lesbian Choir to do that. Previously, the members of the community and other members of the diocese in Brisbane have written to the bishop in very positive terms, etc. However, the bishop has been very adamant he will not talk.
He wants to talk just with the priest that he's put in charge there, the administrator, which he's now sacking, and he doesn't really want to talk to the community.
No. No, but it is a community that is the whole body of the church.
It's a very old Catholic way of doing things, the hierarchical pope to bishop to priest to community. But the way it seems to be working at the moment is totally ignoring the 1,300 strong people. That's how many were there on the weekend across the three masses.
That's right. Well, the Catholic Church is an autocracy, not a democracy. So, and that's the way it's always been.
And the point is, over the last few months, as things have unfolded there, there's not a hatred or a disrespect or a massive vendetta or evil intent against the Archbishop that's coming through from the community. It's like we just want to exist and do what we're doing.
That's correct. As a faith community, it is the Catholic faith in substance that we're looking at, not the form, not the performance, not the robes that a priest might have to wear.
Yeah.
Because the priests at St. Mary's don't wear robes.
Go around naked, but you know.
No. They wear the sacramental stole at the appropriate times throughout the service. But they don't get around in these colourful garbs of the mid-centuries at all.
Exactly. Being there on the weekend was amazing. People from a whole range of ages, genders, sexualities. It was just such a broad community. People in wheelchairs, disabilities, just single parents. It was just a fantastic environment. It always has been.
Yes, it has been. Yeah.
And we really hope it continues. Thanks for coming in tonight, Vince. We're talking to Vince Kinnert, who's a part of the community at St. Mary's South Brisbane that's going through monumental change at the moment. What the hell that means over the next 2 weeks, we don't know. I'm Mark Jeffrey.
And our thanks to John Frame for production assistance. Archbishop Bathersby has ordered Father Kennedy to vacate St. Mary's Church or risk arrest. We'll continue to follow this story.
And I don't believe when they say God turns his back on the Jew, the black, the Muslim, the gay. Show me where Jesus said you're not all children of God. Show me where hate is cruel and judge the cruel. Here's a broken heart. You love, you won't know him, you won't know him.
Coming up with a brief but clever introduction for Edward Albee is no doubt a fool's errand. America's leading Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winning playwright provocateur, author of The Zoo Story, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and so many others, calls his plays a stand against the fiction that everything in this slipping land of ours is peachy keen. Albee had a delightful conversation about being gay, not to mention art, life, and death, with This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
I was an orphan. I was adopted into a rich family. Their values were, I thought, pretty unfortunate. Even very young, I didn't like their values. My adoptive family took me down to Palm Beach, Florida every winter when they had a house on the ocean. You can't imagine how terrible Palm Beach was. Black people had to leave the island of Palm Beach by sunset. Of course, no Jews were allowed to have property there. How I turned out to be a human being, in spite of all of that, I really don't know. Maybe because I was not theirs.
As you were deciding to become a playwright...
I decided to become a playwright because I failed at everything else.
So you wrote some fiction and poetry as well,
right? Sure. I started off with poetry. I wrote the two worst novels that could ever be written by an American teenager. But I figured out that I was a writer since I was incompetent to become a composer, which is what I wanted first.
Oh, I notice in your plays that they're very musical.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Some of your influences...
Well, I had more influences than you can possibly imagine since I read more than most kids, listened to more classical music than most kids, and looked at art more than most kids did. So I was being happily bombarded constantly by the other arts.
What happened then when you actually began to write plays?
With the exception of one play I wrote when I was 12 and a half, except for that, I didn't write my first play, The Zoo Story, until I was 28, and I'd failed at all of the branches of writing. When I wrote The Zoo Story, I realized something interesting. Edward, this is better than anything else you've ever written, mm-hmm. and this may be okay. When I wrote that play, I had a sense, you know?
How do you think American theater has changed from when you were young to what's happening today?
The terrible commercial things that have happened to theater. The awful killing hand of commerce has really done serious damage to our theater. The costs of producing a play now are prohibitive, and the cost of an audience going to a play is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. When we did my play, The Zoo Story, on Crap's Last Tape off Broadway in 1960, the tickets were $2.50. Now off Broadway, the tickets are $75, mm-hmm. and inflation hasn't done that. With inflation, it would only be a third of that. All of the costs have gone up, and so you can't get young people going to the theater, and you can't get low-income people going to the theater, and that's who we need there.
Well, and you've talked about the need for people to be rebellious and for young people to rebel against things, and that comes up in your plays. And
yeah, but only against the things that should be rebelled against. That's what's wrong with our educational system. We don't educate people in something that used to be called civics, where you were taught how government functions and where the errors are. Nobody's taught that stuff anymore, so a lot of people are rebelling without knowing how to fix anything. I used to talk to students in the early 60s during the rebellious times, and their hearts were in the right place, their minds were in the right place, but you couldn't talk dialectic to them for more than 2 minutes before they were out of their depth. That was a shame. If they'd known more specifically about how to fix what they were angry about, we could have accomplished a lot more.
Mr. Albee, you've talked about the need for arts education as well, and can you tell us a little bit about why we're not having that?
You can't have a civilization without a comprehensive arts understanding in the country. Our public schools do not teach the arts. I went to private schools, being adopted by that rich family. I went to private schools. I got a great education. And most people aren't getting that education now, and it's terrible, and we're supposed to be a civilization.
Do you view your work as dark comedy?
I don't think in those terms. I think of what I write as plays. Dark comedy, light tragedy, I don't think in those terms. It's a play. It's something I want people to go to and pay attention to. What the characters say, what they don't say, what the meanings are, the implications are. Knowing that no two people see the same play, which is very important to remember.
You've always rejected labels, even the term absurdist playwright, even though you're considered by many people America's first great absurdist.
Yeah, because most people don't know what the term means.
You've also rejected gay playwright.
Well, I'm a playwright who happens to be gay. Does that make me a gay playwright? I don't know. Maybe if you only write about gay themes, then you're a gay playwright. I don't know. All labels diminish in some way.
When you started writing, was there a gay community around? I mean, were people out then, or did people...
You mean when I was nine, living at home, started writing poetry?
You did a lot of your formative artistic growth in Greenwich Village, and so there was quite a gay scene in that area.
Remember, my family sent me to private schools, and they sent me away to boarding schools, and boy, boarding schools. I came out as soon as it was possible, and I've enjoyed being gay ever since. I had no trouble with it, whatever.
Is there something that you would like to say that you really want people to know and nobody asks you?
After 35 years with a great lover, I've been single for 4 years now. In case anybody's interested in an 80-year-old.
You were friends with Ned Roram and...
Oh, sure, I still see Ned. He's doing pretty well. He gained a little weight, which he should lose.
Harold Pinter, old friend of yours, passed away.
Yes, Harold and I were good friends.
Harold Pinter was the great British playwright.
Harold and I were both very much affected by Sam Beckett, one of the greatest playwrights of the second half of the 20th century. But I think we both managed to develop our own sound and our own language, so the influence was helpful and not limiting. I admired Harold's political stances, and I admired his plays a lot, and we liked each other a lot.
Is there a play that you've written that you like more than others?
It's always the one that I'm writing now.
And are you writing one now?
I'm writing two. I always have two in my head. One is a relief from the other.
Now, are you going to tell us about what they are?
No, if I'm wrong?
You speak about death in your plays a lot.
Well, there are only two things to write about, life and death.
And which is your favorite?
You know, we've got death ahead of us, all of us, and we better participate in living as much as we can, as long as we can.
Going to the theater should make you participate in your own life. You've said things to that effect.
I don't think you should go to the theater and not have anything happen to you. I think every time you go to any art experience, you should be changed, or you should learn something about yourself that you didn't know before. That's the only way you can keep your own intellect evolving.
That was living legend Edward Albee in conversation with soon-to-be legendary Dixie Trichel and John Townsend. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Mark Jeffrey with John Frain, and Dixie Trichel and John Townsend contributed program material. Musically, you heard excerpts from Show Me by Christian Andresen and Wen Xin Yang with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra performed some of composer Ned Roram's Cello Concerto. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, Aero FM Masterton, New Zealand, KEUL Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Anyone interested in promoting human rights and freedom from oppression is welcome to join Students for a Democratic Society. Please contact us at stsuhtx@gmail.com.
If you believe in change through action, please contact us at stsuhtx@gmail.com.
You're listening to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
90.1 KPFT Houston, Texas.
University of Houston Students Against Sweatshops presents a screening of Machilopolis with a special appearance from Carmen Duran from Tijuana, one of the workers featured in the film. Wednesday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at Cullen Auditorium at the University of Houston. Carmen and her fellow workers were left holding the bag when the company Sanyo closed their factory and stiffed them on back pay. Carmen fought back and won. See this empowering story about the ravages of NAFTA and dictator capitalism. Wednesday, February 18th, 7 p.m., Cullen Auditorium at U of H. Call 832-771-7263 or email uhusas@gmail.com for more information. This is KPFT, 90.1 FM, Radio for Peace.
It's Valentine's Day weekend and some lonely hearts are looking for love. Every year, dogs and cats are abandoned for little or no reason. Many of these loyal companions are looking for a second chance with a person who can provide the care and affection they need. During down times, animals contribute to mental health and well-being. Adult cats and dogs who are past those rough years, as well as puppies and kittens, are just waiting to give something back to you. Please consider pet adoption. Friday to Sunday.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.